This is Audible.
Johnny Tremaine by Esther Forbes.
Chapter 1. Up and About. On rocky islands, gulls woke. Time to be about their business. Silently, they floated in on the town, but when their icy eyes sighted the first dead fish, first bits of garbage about the ships and wharves, they began to scream and quarrel. The cocks in Boston backyards had long before cried the coming of day. Now the hens were also awake, scratching, clucking, laying eggs. Cats in malt houses, granaries, shipholds, mansions, and hovels caught a last mouse, settled down to wash their fur and sleep. Cats did not work by day. In stables, horses shook their halters and whinnied. In barns, cows lowed to be milked. Boston slowly opened its eyes, stretched, and woke. The sun struck in horizontally from the east, flashing upon weather vanes, brass cocks and arrows, here a glass-eyed Indian, there a copper grasshopper, and the bells in the steeples cling-clanged, telling the people it was time to be up and about. In hundreds of houses, sleepy women woke sleepier children. Get up and to work. Ephraim, get to the pump, fetch mother water. Anne, get to the barn, milk the cow, and drive her to the common. Start the fire, Silas. Put on a clean shirt, James. Dolly, if you aren't up before I count 10. And so, in a crooked little house at the end of Hancock's Wharf on Crowded Fish Street, Mrs. Lapham stood at the foot of a ladder leading to the attic where her father-in-law's apprentices slept. These boys were luckier than most apprentices. Their master was too feeble to climb ladders. The middle-aged mistress too stout. It was only her bellows that could penetrate to their quarters, not her heavy hands. Boys? No answer. Dove? Coming, ma'am. Dove turned over for one more snooze. Frustrated, she shook the ladder she was too heavy to climb. She wished she could shake them limbs of Satan. Dusty Miller, let me hear your voice. Here it is, piped Dusty pertly. Her voice changed to pleading. Johnny, you get them two lazy lug-a-beds up. Get them down here. You pull that worthless dove right out of bed. You give Dusty a kick for me. I'm waiting for him to fetch fresh water so's I can get on with breakfast. Johnny Tremaine was on his feet. He did not bother to answer his mistress. He turned to the fat, pale, almost white-haired boy still wallowing in bed. Hear that, dove? Oh, you, leave me lay, can't you? Grumbling, he swung his legs out of the bed the three boys shared. Johnny was already in his leather breeches, pulling on his coarse shirt, tucking in the tails. He was a rather skinny boy, neither large nor small for 14. He had a thin, sleep-flushed face, light eyes, a wry mouth, and fair, lank hair. Although 2 years younger than the swinish dove, inches shorter, pounds lighter, he knew, and old Mr. Lapham knew, busy Mrs. Lapham and her four daughters and Dove and Dusty also knew, that Johnny Tremaine was the boss of the attic and almost of the house. Dusty Miller was 11. It was easy for Johnny to say, "Look sharp, Dusty," and little Dusty looked sharp. But Dove, his first name had long ago been forgotten, hated the way the younger apprentice lorded it over him, telling him when to go to bed, when to get up, criticizing his work in the silversmith's shop as though he were already a master smith. Hadn't he been working 4 years for Mr. Lapham and Johnny only two? Why did the boy have to be so infernally smart with his hands and his tongue? Look here, Johnny, I'm not getting up 'cause you tell me to. I'm getting up 'cause Mrs. Lapham tells me to. All right, said Johnny blandly. Just so you're up. There was only one window in the attic. Johnny always stood before it as he dressed. He liked this view down the length of Hancock's Wharf. Counting houses, shops, stores, sail lofts, and one great ship after another, home again after their voyaging, content as cows waiting to be milked. He watched the gulls, so fierce and beautiful, fighting and screaming among the ships. Beyond the wharf was the sea and the rocky islands where gulls nested. He knew to the fraction of a moment how long it would take the two other boys to get into their clothes. Swinging about, he leaped for the head of the ladder, hardly looking where he went. One of Dove's big feet got there first. Johnny stumbled, caught himself, and swung silently about at Dove. "Gosh, Johnny, I'm sorry," sniggered Dove. "Sorry, eh? You're going to be a lot sorrier. I just didn't notice. You do that again, and I'll beat you up again. You overgrown pig of a louse, you..." He went on from there. Mr. Lapham was strict about his boys swearing, but Johnny could get along very well without. Whatever pig of a louse was, it did describe the whitish, flaccid, parasitic Dove. Little Dusty froze as the older boys quarreled. He knew Johnny could beat up Dove any time he chose. He worshipped Johnny and did not like Dove, but he and Dove were bound together by their common servitude to Johnny's autocratic rule. Half of Dusty sympathized with one boy, half of him with the other in this quarrel. It seemed to him that everybody liked Johnny. Old Mr. Lapham because he was so clever at his work, Mrs. Lapham because he was reliable, the four Lapham girls because he sassed them so, and then grinned. Most of the boys in the other shops around Hancock's Wharf liked Johnny, although some of them fought him on sight. Only Dove hated him. Sometimes he would get Dusty in a corner, tell him in a hoarse whisper how he was going to get a pair of scissors and cut out Johnny Tremaine's heart. But he never dared do more than trip him, and then whine out of it. "Someday," said Johnny, his good nature restored, "I'll kill you, Dove. In the meantime, you have your uses. You get out the buckets and run to North Square and fetch back drinking water." The Laphams were on the edge of the sea. Their well was brackish. "Look here, Mrs. Lapham said Dusty was to go and..." "Get along with you, don't you go arguing with me." Fetching water, sweeping, helping in the kitchen, tending the annealing furnace in the shop were the unskilled work the boys did. Already Johnny was so useful at his bench he could never be spared for such labor. It was over a year since he had carried charcoal or a bucket of water, touched a broom, or helped Mrs. Lapham brew ale. His ability made him semi-sacred. He knew his power and reveled in it. He could easily have made friends with stupid Dove, for Dove was lonely and admired Johnny as well as envied him. Johnny preferred to bully him. Johnny, followed by his subdued slaves, slipped down the ladder with an easy flop. To his left was Mr. Lapham's bedroom. The door was closed. Old Master did not go to work these days until after breakfast. Starting the boys off, getting things going, he left to his bustling daughter-in-law. Johnny knew the old man, whom he liked, was already up and dressed. He took this time every day to read the Bible. To his right, the only other bedroom was open. It was here Mrs. Lapham slept with her four poor fatherless girls, as she called them. The two biggest and most capable were already in the kitchen helping their mother. Scylla was sitting on the edge of one of the unmade beds brushing Izana's hair. It was wonderful hair, seemingly spun out of gold. It was the most wonderful thing in the whole house. Gently Scylla brushed and brushed, her little oddly shaped face turned away, pretending she did not know that Johnny was there. He knew neither Scylla nor Izana would politely wish him the conventional good morning. He was lingering for his morning insult. Scylla never lifted her eyes as she put down her brush and very deliberately picked up a hair ribbon. The Laphams couldn't afford such luxuries, but somehow Scylla always managed to keep her little sister in hair ribbons. Very carefully she began to tie the child's halo of pale curls. She spoke to Izana in so low a voice it was almost a whisper. "There goes that wonderful Johnny Tremaine." Izana took her cue, already so excited she was jumping up and down. "Johnny worth his weight in gold, Tremaine." "If you don't think he is wonderful, ask him, Izana." "Oh, just how wonderful are you, Johnny?" Johnny said nothing, stood there, and grinned. The two youngest Laphams were always insulting him, not only about how smart he was, but how smart he thought he was. He didn't care. Every now and then they would say something that irritated him, and then together they would shout, "Johnny's mad." As an apprentice, he was little more than a slave until he had served his master 7 years. He had no wages. The very clothes upon his back belonged to his master, but he did not, as he himself said, take much. There were only four real bedrooms in the Lapham house, the two bedrooms on the second floor, the kitchen, and the workshop on the first. Johnny paused in the lower entry. In the kitchen he could see his formidable mistress bent double over the hearth. Madge, in time, would look like her mother, but at 18 she was handsome in a coarse-grained, red-faced, thick-waisted way. Dorcas was 16, built like Madge, but not so loud-voiced nor as roughly good-natured. Poor Dorcas thirsted for elegance. She would rub flour on her face, trying to look pale, like the fashionable ladies she saw in the street. She wore her clothes so tight, hoping to look ethereal, she looked apoplectic. How they all had laughed when her stays burst in the middle of a meeting with a loud pop. She did not call her mother Ma, but Mother, or Respected Mother, and in her efforts to avoid the rough, easy speech of her associates on Hancock's Wharf, she talked, when she remembered it, in a painfully prissy, proper way. Johnny thought Madge pretty bad, and Dorcas even worse, but he was philosophical about them. He wouldn't mind having them for sisters. They certainly were good, hard workers, except when Dorcas tried too hard to be elegant. It had already been decided that when he grew up to be a really great silversmith, as Mr. Lapham said he would, he was to marry Scylla, and together they would inherit Grandpa's silver business. Scylla was just his age. This idea seemed only mildly offensive to both of them. Johnny had no particular objections. Smart apprentices were always getting ahead by marrying into their masters' families. He had been flattered when Mrs. Lapham had told him that he might marry one of her girls. Of course, Madge and Dorcas, they were fine, big, buxom girls, would make better wives. But didn't he think they were a little old for him? True, Scylla was just a mite spindly, but she was coming along fine. Izana was so weakly it didn't seem worth making any plans for her maturity. So it was to be Scylla. Johnny had often heard Mrs. Lapham say that Izana was hardly worth the bother she was to raise. The little girl, her beautiful brown eyes wide with interest, never seemed to mind these remarks of her mother, but they made Scylla cry. Scylla loved Izana. She was proud when people stopped her on the street and said, "Is that little angel your sister?" She did not mind that there were so many things Izana could not keep down, like pork gravy, mince pies, new beer. If Izana got wet, she had a cold. If a cold, a fever. First, Johnny, with a customary look sharp, got the sulky dove in his buckets headed for North Square. Then he took the key to the shop out of his pocket as though he owned it. Dusty, good and quiet as a mouse, followed him. "Look sharp, Dusty," Johnny said. "Get the annealing furnace going. Get to the coal house. Fetch in charcoal. You have to do it by yourself. I want to get this buckle mended before breakfast." Already the day's bustle had begun up and down the wharf. A man was crying fish. Sailors were heave-hoeing at their ropes. A woman was yelling that her son had fallen into the water. A parrot said distinctly, "King Hancock." Johnny could smell hemp and spices, tar and salt water, the sun drying fish. He liked his wharf. He sat down at his own bench, before him the innumerable tools of his trade. The tools fitted into his strong, thin hands. His hands fitted the tools. Mr. Lapham was always telling him to give God thanks who had seen fit to make him so good an artisan, not to take it out in lording it over the other boys. That was one of the things Johnny did not let bother him much. Dove came back, his thick lower lip thrust out. The water had slopped over his breeches, down his legs. "Mrs. Lapham doesn't want you in the kitchen." Johnny did not even look up from his buckle. "Naw." "Well then, this spoon you finished yesterday afternoon has to be melted down, made over. You beat it to the wrong gauge." "Did Mr. Lapham say it was wrong?" "No, but it is. It's supposed to match this spoon. Look at it." Dove looked. There was no argument. "So, get out a crucible. Soon as Dusty's got the furnace going, you melt it down and try again." "I'd like to get you in a crucible," thought Dove, "and melt you down. I'd beat you to the proper gauge, 2 years younger than me, and look at him. It was Izana who ran in to tell them that Grandpa was in his chair and breakfast was on the table. The soft brown eyes combined oddly with the flying fair hair. She did look rather like a little angel, Johnny thought, just as people were always telling Scylla on the street, and so graceful. She seemed to float about rather than run. No one to see her would ever guess the number of things she couldn't keep down. 2. Mr. Lapham, as befitted his venerable years and his dignity as master of the house, sat in an armchair at the head of the table. He was a peaceful, kind, remote old man. Although his daughter-in-law was always nagging him to collect bills, finish work when promised, and discipline his apprentices, nothing she said seemed to touch him. He did not even bother to listen. His dull, groping eyes lingered kindly over his boys as they trooped in for breakfast. "Good morning, Dove. Dusty. Good morning, Johnny." "Morning, sir." He took his time blessing the meal. He was a deacon at the Cockerell Church and very pious. Breakfast was good, although no more than a poor artisan could afford. Milk and ale, gruel, sausages and cornbread. Everything was plentiful and well-cooked. The kitchen was as clean or cleaner than many of those in the great houses. Every member of the household had a clean shirt or petticoat. Mrs. Lapham was a great manager, but she cared nothing for genteel manners and was the first to laugh at Dorcas's. "If it please you, Mother, just a touch more maple syrup for me." "Give me that there syrup pitcher" was good enough for her. When the meal was over, Mr. Lapham told Madge to hand him the family Bible. "Johnny, I'm going to ask you to read to us today." Of the three boys, only Johnny could read easily and well. His mother had lived long enough to see that. Dove stumbled shamefully. Dusty usually had the first chapter of Genesis, so that by reading the same thing over and over, he might eventually learn. Madge and Dorcas never cared even to try to read. Mrs. Lapham could not so much as write her name. "Book larnin'," she declared, "scalded no pigs." Scylla was so anxious to learn and teach Izana that whenever Johnny read, she leaned over the book and shaped the words to herself as he said them. They sat beside each other at the table. To help her, Johnny always kept a finger on the lines as he read. Johnny now opened the book, keeping it between himself and Scylla. "Where, sir, shall I read?" Mr. Lapham's selections for his boys were sometimes designed to point out some fault in a member of his household, especially in the reader. Dove was always being asked to read about sluggards and going to ants. Johnny was told where to begin in Leviticus. "Ye shall make you no idols nor graven image, neither rear you up a standing image." What was the old master driving at? Couldn't a silversmith put a dragon's snout on a chocolate pot? Soon the surging roll of the words, the pleasure of the sound of his voice coming so clearly out of his mouth, made him stop looking for possible object lessons in the text. Scylla was leaning over him, breathing hard in her efforts to keep up. Mrs. Lapham sat agape. Soon she'd be saying it was just like having a preacher live with them to hear Johnny Tremaine read Holy Writ. "Finish with the 19th verse." "And I will break the pride of your power, and I will make your heaven as iron and your earth as brass." Turn to Proverbs 11, second verse. "When pride cometh, then cometh shame, but with the lowly is wisdom." Proverbs 16, 18. "Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall." "Now close the book. Stand up and expound to us all the meaning of God's word." Johnny stood up. His skin was thin, and he could feel himself flush. So the old gentleman was after him for his pride again, was he? "It is all another way of saying, God's way of saying, that pride goeth before a fall." "Yes, and why?" "Because God doesn't like pride." Johnny sounded sulky. "Do you think God would like you?" "Not especially." Dusty was the first to snicker. "What does God like?" "Humble people," said Johnny wrathfully. "He sends punishments to people who are too proud." "Now, Johnny, I want you to raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Johnny Tremaine, swear from this day onward, to walk more humbly and modestly before God and man. To walk more humbly and modestly before God and man. Just because some folks are not so smart," the old master gave Dove and Dusty a pitying glance, "it's no reason why other folks should go around rubbing their noses in their own stupidities." Either Dove or Dusty kicked Johnny under the table. Madge and Dorcas were giggling. Mrs. Lapham was already scraping the trenchers clean, getting on with her work. She did not hold much by Grandpa's soul-searchings. The master, followed by Dove and Dusty, left for the shop. Johnny heard Scylla give an exaggeratedly pious sigh. He stopped. "When the meek inherit the earth," she said, "I doubt Johnny gets as much as one divot of sod." This was too much for Johnny. He turned on the little girls. "When they do," he stormed. "Syl, you can just about keep your mouth shut until then. You know, you did look pretty funny standing up there and saying all those humble things Grandpa told you to." Izana was almost jumping out of her pinafore in glee. "Johnny's mad," she chanted. "Johnny's mad." "Yes," murmured Scylla, looking at him critically. "You're right, baby dear. His ears are red. That always means he's mad."
"Johnny's ears are red," squealed Izana.
Johnny stalked out of the kitchen as stiff-legged as a fighting tomcat. His ears were scarlet. 3. He decided to do nothing that would lay him open to such criticism for at least a morning, but he couldn't help it. First, if he had not jumped on Dusty, the furnace would have gone out. Then he had to explain to his master how badly Dove had done the spoon. Although he tried to sound humble, he was soon behaving perfectly naturally, standing over Mr. Lapham with his notebook in his hand, reading off exactly how those spoons had been ordered. Mr. Lapham was a fine craftsman. His weakness was that he never wrote down what was ordered or even listened very carefully. If a patron ordered a sauce boat, he would get a fine one, perhaps a month after it had been promised. Sometimes it weighed a little more, sometimes a little less than it was supposed to. Sometimes it had splayed feet when a gudroon edge had been asked for. Mrs. Lapham herself had told Johnny he must always be on hand and write down exactly what the order was. This was necessary, but it did seem cheeky to see the 14-year-old boy standing there telling his master what he was supposed to do. Johnny, having started off everybody on his work, even Mr. Lapham, decided to go to the coal house and see if he should order more charcoal. It was such things Mr. Lapham never thought about until too late. There were two basketfuls of charcoal and at least half another scattered over the floor. That was the other boy's fault. Johnny himself was too valuable to carry charcoal. He started to yell for Dusty, thought better of it, and went to work arranging the dirty stuff himself. When he was a master craftsman, he wasn't going to buy charcoal by the basket. He was going to own his own willows, say, out in Milton. That would save, say, 2 pence a basket. In a year, he began to figure. And he wouldn't take just any boy whose father or mother wanted him to be a silversmith. He'd pick and choose. He saw himself sitting at his bench, his shop crowded with boys with mothers, boys with fathers, all begging to be allowed to work for him. He'd not talk to the parents, only to the boys. What church did they go to? King's Chapel? All right. Describe to me at least one piece of silver you see used every Lord's Supper. They could not answer that. He'd know they hadn't got silver in their blood. But how could he find which boys had nice hands?
"Johnny!"
It was Madge's voice that pulled him out of his reverie. He wiped his black hands on his leather breeches and stepped out into the sunlight of the tiny backyard.
"What is it, my girl?"
He often thus arrogantly addressed his master's granddaughters, really his own mistresses. Ma sent me. Johnny, it's Mr. Hancock himself. He's in the shop ordering something. Stand by and listen, or Grandpa will get it wrong. Dorcas next flung herself upon him, too excited to be elegant. Johnny, hurry, hurry, hurry. It's Mr. Hancock. He's ordering a sugar basin. Can't you go faster? Shake a leg. Izana was jumping about him like a wild thing. Help! Help! She shrieked. But it was Scylla who thought to offer him her clean apron for a towel as he washed off the charcoal at the yard pump. Oh, but he must hurry. And there was Mrs. Lapham tapping at him from the kitchen window. Slowly he approached the house, the girls chattering about him. Close to the shop door was a tiny African holding a slender gray horse by the bridle. Johnny noted the Hancock arms on the door of the gig. He felt so good he could not help saying to the black child, "Mind that horse doesn't trample our flowers." There were no flowers in the Lapham's yard. "Oh, no, sir," said little Jehu, rolling his eyes. He thought from the attention this boy was receiving from his escorting ladies, he must be a boy of consequence. Johnny slipped into the shop so quietly that Mr. Hancock did not even look up. It was he who owned this great wharf, the warehouses, many of the fine ships tied up along it. He owned sail lofts and shops, and also dwelling houses standing at the head of the wharf. He owned the Lapham House. He was the richest man in New England. Such a wealthy patron might lift the Laphams from poverty to affluence. Mr. Hancock was comfortably seated in the one armchair which was kept in the shop for patrons. "When I'm master," thought Johnny, "there are going to be two armchairs, and I'll sit in one." Unobtrusively, Johnny got his notebook and pencil. Dove and Dusty were paralyzed into complete inaction. "Do something," Johnny muttered to them, determined his master's shop should look busy. Dusty could not take his eyes off the green velvet coat, sprigged white waistcoat, silver buttons and buckles on the great man, but he picked up a soldering iron and nervously dropped it. "And to be done next Monday, a week from today," Mr. Hancock was saying. "I want it as a birthday present to my venerable Aunt Lydia Hancock. This is the creamer of the set. Only this morning a clumsy maid melted the sugar basin. I want you to make me a new one. I want it about so high, so broad." Johnny glanced at the delicate lace-ruffled gesturing hands, guessed the inches, and wrote it down. Mr. Lapham was looking down at his own gnarled fingers. He nodded and said nothing. He did not even glance at the cream pitcher as Mr. Hancock set it down on a workbench. Johnny's hard, delicate hands, so curiously strong and mature for his age, reached quickly to touch the beautiful thing. It was almost as much by touch as by sight he judged fine silver. It was indeed old-fashioned, more elaborate than the present mode. The garlands on it were rounded out in repoussé work. Mr. Lapham would have to do the repousséing. Johnny hadn't been taught that. He looked at the handle. A sugar basin would have to have two such handles, and they would be larger than the one on the creamer. He'd shape it in wax, make a mold. He had cast hundreds of small things since he had gone to work for Mr. Lapham, but nothing so intricate and beautiful as the woman with folded wings whose body formed the handle. He thought he had never seen anything quite so enchanting as this picture. It must have been the work of one of the great smiths of 40 or 50 years ago. Although he had not intended to address Mr. Hancock, he had said before he thought, "John Coney, sir?" Mr. Hancock turned to him. He had a handsome face, a little worn, as though either his health was bad or he did not sleep well. "Look at the mark, boy." Johnny turned it over, expecting to see the familiar rabbit of the great Mr. Coney. Instead, there was a pellet, and L, and a pellet. "Your master made that creamer 40 years ago. He made the entire set." "You made it?" He had never guessed there had been a time when Mr. Lapham could do such beautiful work. At last Mr. Lapham raised his protuberant eyes. "I remember when your uncle, Mr. Thomas Hancock, sir, ordered that set. 'Make it big and make it handsome,' he said. 'Bigger and handsomer than anything in Boston. As big and handsome as my lady is. Make it as rich as I am.'" John Hancock laughed. "That is just the way my uncle used to talk." He was so sure of his own good breeding he could laugh affectionately at the rich, quick vulgarities of the uncle who had adopted him and from whom he had inherited his fortune. He stood up, a tall, slender man who stooped as he stood and walked. The fine clothes seemed a little pathetic. He had a soft voice, and low, "But you have not as yet said whether or not you can make my sugar basin for me, and have it done by Monday next? Of course I thought first of you, because you made the original. But there are other silversmiths perhaps you would rather not undertake." Mr. Lapham was in a study. "I've got the time, the materials, and the boys to help. I can get right at it. But honestly, sir, I don't know. Perhaps I haven't got the skill anymore. I've not done anything so fine for 30 years. I'm not what I used to be, and—" Although neither of the two men could see the door leading from the hall into the shop, Johnny could. There was Mrs. Lapham in her morning apron, her face purple with excitement, and all four girls crowded about her listening, gesturing at Johnny. "Say yes." All five faces, big and little, mouthed at him. "Yes, yes, yes." So they had forgotten morning prayers, had they? Wanted him to take charge. "We can do it, Mr. Hancock." "Bless me," exclaimed the gentleman, not accustomed to apprentices who settled matters while their masters pondered. "Yes, sir, and you shall have it delivered at your house a week from today, 7 o'clock, Monday morning. And it's going to be just exactly right." Mr. Lapham looked at Johnny gratefully. "Certainly, sir, I'm humbly grateful for your august patronage." He was not a proud man. He was relieved that Johnny had stepped in and settled matters. Mr. Hancock bowed and turned to go, but none of the boys thought to run ahead and open the door for him, so Mrs. Lapham, apron and all, barged in, her red arms bare to the elbow, her felt slippers flapping at her bare heels, and did, or overdid, the courtesies for them all. Hardly was the door closed than there was a rap on it. Little Jehu came mincing in, a glitter of bright colors. He solemnly laid 3 pieces of silver on the nearest bench and recited his piece. "My master, Mr. John Hancock, Esquire, bids me leave these coins, one for each of the poor work boys, hoping they will drink his health and be diligent at their benches." Then he was gone. "Hoping they will vote for him when they are grown up and have enough property."
"Don't you ever vote for Mr. Hancock, sir?" asked Johnny.
"I never do. I don't hold much with these fellows that are always trying to stir up trouble between us and England. Maybe English rule ain't always perfect, but it's good enough for me. Fellows like Mr. Hancock and Sam Adams calling themselves patriots and talking too much. Not reading God's word, like their parents did, which tells us to be humble. But he's my landlord, and I don't say much."
Johnny was not listening. He sat with the pitcher in his hand. To think the poor, humble old fellow once had been able to make things like that.
Well, he was going to turn the trick again before he died, even if Johnny had to stand over him and make him.
4. The sun stood directly overhead, pressing its heat down upon the town as though it held an enormous brass basin. There was not wind enough to take a catboat from Hancock's wharf to Noddle Island. In the Lapham shop, windows and doors were left open to catch what breeze might come up the wharf, but there wasn't any breeze. Old Mr. Lapham had worked well in the morning. He said if Johnny could do the handles, he himself could get the basin done in time, but after dinner he had gone down to the old willow behind the coal house, put a basket over his head, and gone to sleep. Dove and Dusty had, therefore, left to go swimming. Johnny was making out of wax an exact replica of the pitcher handle, only enlarging it. He tried again and again, never quite satisfied with his work, but confident that he could do it. It was long past dinner hour when he crossed the entry into the kitchen. The fire was out, the table cleared except for his place. Scylla had evidently been left to wait on him whenever he felt like eating. The success of Mr. Hancock's order was so dependent upon him No one would scold him today because he chose to be an hour late. Johnny took his seat, and Scylla put down the slate she had been writing on. She gave him a piece of cold meat pie, a flat loaf of rye bread, dried apples, and ran down cellar to fetch him a flagon of cold ale. He drank the ale, and then more leisurely began on the pie. With hardly a word, Scylla went back to the settle where Izana was sprawled and picked up her slate. She drew very well. It would be just about nothing, Johnny thought, to teach that girl to write. "She's doing it for you, Johnny," Izana said at last.
"What are you doing for me, Syl?"
"She's designing you a beautiful mark so when you are man-grown and master smith you can stamp your silver with it."
"I've 5 more years to go. No matter how good my work may be, I have to mark it with your grandpa's old pellets and L's."
"Johnny's forgotten morning prayers and all those wonderful humble people," said Scylla. "Look, I've got your J and T sort of entwined."
Too hard to read. Then, too..."
He could not imagine why he came out with this secret.
"When I'm Master Smith, I'm going to use all 3 of my initials."
"All 3?
J-L-T.
Neither of the girls had ever heard of a poor working boy with 3 names.
"You're not making up?" Scylla asked, almost respectfully. "I've heard tell of folk with 3 names, but I never saw one before."
"Look at me, my girl." He got up to go back to the shop.
"Wait, Johnny. What is that middle name? It begins with L?"
"As far as you are concerned, it ends with L, too."
"I'll bet it's something so awful you're ashamed of it, like Ladybug or Leapfrog." "I'll bet it's lamentable."
Johnny grinned, untempted by her insults. In the shop it was so hot he could not handle the wax. The solitude in which he worked depressed him a little. For the first time he was afraid he could not get the handles right. All the shops had stopped work because of the heat. He could hear the other boys running and splashing, diving off the wharf into the cold water. He locked the shop. Now even Mr. Lapham would have to ask him if he wanted to get in, and he ran off to swim. Later, after sunset, he could get on with the model, even if he had to work by lamplight. 5. When at last he blew out his lamp, Johnny had made an exact replica of the winged woman, only larger. He looked at it and knew that it was not, for some reason, quite right. Instead of going up to the attic to sleep, he crossed into the kitchen and got an old mattress. The clock struck midnight, and he was asleep. He woke, and it was still dark night. Someone was in the room with him, and he thought of thieves.
"Who's there?"
he yelled roughly.
"It's me. Johnny, I wasn't going to wake you up if you were already asleep, but..."
"What's wrong, Scylla?"
"Johnny, it's Izana. She's sick again."
"What does her mother say?" Scylla began to cry.
"I don't want to tell her. She'd just say poor baby wasn't worth raising."
Johnny was tired. At the moment, he had a sneaking sympathy with Mrs. Lapham's point of view.
"What seems to be wrong?"
"She's so hot. She says if she can't get a breath of air, she'll throw up." This was a very old but dire threat.
"There might be a little down at the end of the wharf. Fetch her down."
Seemed it was always like this. Whenever things went wrong and he was tired, Scylla was after him to help her nurse Izana. Nevertheless, he carried her in his thin, strong arms. She was a tiny child for 8. The whitey gold hair that he secretly admired so much got into his mouth and he wished she was bald. Izana giggled. On one side of the deserted wharf were warehouses, on the other were ships. Not a person was abroad except themselves. The child grew heavier and heavier.
"Want to walk now, Izana? You'd be cooler walking."
"I like to ride."
"Well, just so you are satisfied."
"Johnny," said Scylla crossly, "are you being sarcastic to baby?" Yes.
How do you feel, dear?
I feel like I'm gonna throw up.
Oh, you get down then, said Johnny. That settles it.
But he carried her to the very end of the wharf. Suddenly he felt cool fingers of air lifting the wet, fair hair on his forehead. The perspiration under his arms, dripping down his chest, evaporated and the prickly sensation was delightful. Izana cried, "The wind! The wind! Blow, wind, blow!" It did not blow, but flowed over them and cooled them. The three sat in a row, their feet dangling over the water below. They sat well apart at first, with arms outstretched, soaking themselves in the freshness of the sea air. For a long time they sat and said nothing. Then Izana put her head in Scylla's lap. Scylla leaned against Johnny. The two girls were almost asleep. Johnny was wide awake.
"Johnny," murmured Izana, "tell us a story."
"I don't know any."
"Johnny," said Scylla, "tell us the story of your middle name."
"It isn't a story. It's just a fact."
"What is it?"
Although by daytime, and if Scylla had teased him, he never would have told. The darkness of the night, the remoteness of the place where they sat, an affection he felt for the girls and they for him, made everything seem different. After a long pause, he said, "It is Light."
"So, you are really John Light Tremaine?"
"No. My baptized Bible name is Jonathan. I've always been called Johnny. That's the way my papers were made out to your grandpa. I am Jonathan Light Tremaine."
"Why, that's just like Merchant Light."
"Just like." "You don't suppose you're related?"
"I do suppose.
But I don't know. Light's not a common name. And we are both Jonathan. Of course, I've thought about it. Some. When I see him rolling around in his coach, strutting about with his laces and gold-headed canes. But I don't aim ever to think too much about it."
Izana was almost asleep. "Tell more, Johnny," she murmured.
"Merchant Light is so very rich..."
"How rich, like Mr. Hancock?"
"Not quite. Almost. He's so rich, gold and silver are like dust to him."
"You mean, at Light Mansion, Mrs. Light sweeps up gold and silver in a dustpan?"
"Mrs. Light doesn't sweep, you silly, not with her own fair hands. For one thing, she's dead. And for another, if she weren't, she'd just snap her fingers and maids would come running in frilly starched caps. They'd curtsy and squeak, 'Yes, ma'am. No, ma'am, and if it please you, ma'am.' Then Mrs. Light would say, 'You dirty sluts, look at that gold dust under the bed. I could write my name in the silver dust on the mirror over that mantle. Fetch your mops and rags, you bow-legged, cross-eyed, chattering monkeys.'"
"Diamonds, too? To clean up diamonds, they need brooms."
"Oh, Johnny, tell more." "Once the rubies spilled, and the cook, a monstrous fine woman, I've seen her, thought they were currants. She put them in a fruit cake, and Merchant Light broke a front tooth on one."
"A fact, Johnny?"
"Well, it's a fact that Merchant Light's got a broken front tooth. I saw it as I stood watching him."
Scylla said, "You watch him much?"
He answered a little miserably,
"It's just like I can't help it. I don't mean ever to think of them."
Izana murmured, "What do they do with their pearls?"
"They drink their pearls."
"What?"
"Like a queen of Egypt my mother told me of before she died. She drank her pearls in vinegar, just to show off. That Lavinia Light is always showing off, too."
Izana was asleep.
"You never speak of your mother, Johnny. She hadn't been dead more'n a few weeks when you first came here. You never talked about her at all. Was that because you liked her so much? Or not at all?"
There was a long pause.
"Liked her so much," he said at last. "We had been living at Townsend, Maine. She got a living for us both by sewing. But when she knew she had to die, she had death inside of her and she knew it. She wanted me taught skilled work, and all I wanted was to be a silversmith. That's why we came to Boston, so's to get me a proper master. She could still sew, but she coughed all the time. Even when she was so weak she could hardly hold a needle, she kept on and on, teaching me reading and writing and all that. She was determined I shouldn't grow up untaught, like Dove and Dusty. She wanted me to be something. That's why you work so hard."
"That's why."
"Mrs. Lapham promised your grandpa would take me on just as soon as she was buried. She died. And he did. That's all."
"What was her name? And how come she, a poor sewing woman, was so well learned?"
"Round about here she called herself just Mrs. Tremaine, but she was born Lavinia-like. It came of gentlefolk."
"Just like Mr. Light's daughter?"
"Yes. She told me once that for over 100 years, Lights had favored Jonathan and Lavinia as names."
"Johnny, didn't she ever go to those rich relatives and say, 'Here I am'?"
"Nope. And she told me not to. Ever. Unless. Only if I'd got to the end of everything. She'd say, 'Johnny, if there is not one thing left for you and you have no trade and no health and God himself has turned away his face from you, then you go to Merchant Light and you show him your cup and tell him your mother told you before she died that you are kin to him. And he will know the kinship,' she said, 'and in pity, he may help you.'"
"Your cup?"
"She said I wasn't to sell it, ever. I was to go hungry and cold first."
"Where's your cup?"
"In my sea chest in the attic. That's why I keep it locked."
"Will you show me your cup?"
"If you swear by your hope of heaven and your fear of hell, never, never mention any of this to anyone. Never tell my true name, nor that I have a cup."
"But Izana..."
"If she's heard anything, she'll think it was a story I made up, like those rubies in the fruitcake." Now it was close to morning. Far off a cock crew. Nearby another answered. The dawn breeze came up off the sea, and the black night turned gray. Scylla was shivering and stood up. Johnny shouldered Izana. 6. He kept his word to Scylla, and as he was putting the little girl back to bed, he slipped to the attic, unlocked his chest, and brought down the cup in the flannel bag his mother had made. He opened the door from the shop to the wharf. Although it was still dark inside the house, outside it was growing lighter and lighter. Gulls flew in from the islands looking for food. Scylla joined him, and he motioned her to follow him out into the twilight of the new day. He drew his cup from its bag. As a small child, he had thought it was the most beautiful thing in the world. It was the reason why he had begged his mother to apprentice him to a silversmith, and there were none in Townsend, Maine. Now he was more critical of the cup. He thought it too chunky. On one side was engraved the crest of the lights. This was an eye rising up from the sea. From its rays of light, or lashes, streamed out, half covering the surface of the cup. It was this emblem Merchant Light had on everything he owned, carved above his counting house on Long Wharf, engraved on all his silver, even on dog collars and harnesses. Miss Lavinia had it stamped on her Spanish leather gloves. Johnny knew it was cut on the slate gravestones of the Light family on Copp's Hill.
"The same as his," said Scylla in wonder.
"And the same motto. Look." She read the words in her halting manner. "Let there be light." And miraculously, as she stumbled over these words, there was light, for the sun came up out of the sea. The children stood and looked at each other.
The girl's face showed her excitement and her fatigue. It was a pointed, sweet little face, her eyes a lighter brown than Izana's, and her hair not so strikingly pale. Johnny whispered, "Just like the sun coming up yonder out of the sea, pushing rays of light ahead of it." Scylla, evidently thinking Johnny was getting beyond himself, said, "Might it not just as well be a setting, I?" It was the first sour remark she had made to him all night. "No, no. My mother said it was a rising eye. But I was to keep whist and mum about it, unless even God has turned away his face. And Scylla, you promised." "By my hope of heaven and my fear of hell." Chapter 2. The Pride of Your Power. The week wore on, each day as hot as the one before, for it was July. Every day after dinner, Mr. Lapham took a long nap under his basket, snoring as gently as he did everything else. Johnny would let him sleep for an hour, then wake him up, scold him, and get him to work. His work was beautiful. The body of the sugar basin was quickly completed, and he began repousseing on it the rich garlands of fruit with the same skill he had had 40 years before. Johnny's own work did not satisfy him as well. He had exactly enlarged the handle in his wax model. Mrs. Lapham and the girls, even Mr. Lapham, said it was fine, and he could go ahead and cast it in silver. It was only Johnny himself who was dissatisfied. Friday evening, when the light was failing and work over, Johnny took the silver pitcher and his own wax model and left the shop. He was in Fish Street, in a minute stopping outside the silver shop of Paul Revere. He didn't dare knock, but he knew that any moment now the silversmith would be closing his shop, leaving for his dwelling in nearby North Square. He was so prosperous a smith that he did not live and work in the same place. So at last he saw Mr. Revere, a stocky, ruddy man, with fine, dark eyes, shutting his shop, taking out his key, preparing to lock up. "Good evening, Mr. Revere." The man smiled with a quick flash of white teeth. He had a quick smile and a quick face and body.
"Good evening, John Tremaine."
The boy had long admired Mr. Revere as the best craftsman in Boston. He had no idea Mr. Revere knew his name. He did not know all the master silversmiths had an eye on him. "Mr. Revere, I'd like to talk with you."
"Man to man," Mr. Revere agreed, opening his shop door, motioning Johnny to follow him.
Johnny's eyes flew about the shop, taking in the fine anvils, the hood above the annealing furnace, the neat nests of crucibles. It was just such a shop he would himself have when he was man-grown. Not much like Mr. Lapham's. Although Paul Revere was as busy a man as there was in all Boston, he took everything so easily in his stride, doing the one thing after another, that he never seemed rushed. So now, because an apprentice stopped him on the street and said he wanted to talk to him, he appeared to have all the time in the world.
"Sir," said Johnny, "it's a matter of handles."
He took the silver pitcher out of the cloth he had wrapped it in, and his own wax model, and explained Mr. Hancock's order.
"So, you want to talk to me as a silversmith to silversmith, do you?"
He had Johnny's wax model in his hands, delicate hands to go with such heavy wrists.
"What does your master say of your work?" "Mr. Lapham won't even look at it much, but he says it's good enough and I can go ahead and cast it tomorrow. I've got to cast it tomorrow because it's Saturday and we can't work Sunday, and it must be done by Monday at 7. Although my master thinks it's all right, I'm not sure."
"He is wrong and you are right. Look, you've just copied the handle on the pitcher too slavishly, just enlarged it. Don't you see that your winged woman looks coarse in comparison? I'd have the figures the same size on both pieces, fill in with a scroll. Then, too, your curve is wrong. The basin is so much bigger you cannot use the same curve. Yours looks hunched up and awkward. It's all a matter of proportion."
He took up with a piece of paper and a pencil and drew off what he meant with one sure sweep of his hand.
"I'd use a curve more like that. See? This is what I meant when I said I'd add a scroll or two below the figure of the winged woman. Not just enlarge her so she looks like a Boston fishwife in comparison to the angel on the picture. See?
I see.
The man looked at him a little curiously.
There was a time, he said, when your own master could have shown you that.
Mr. Lapham is, well, he's feeble.
Not doing very much work these days?
Not what you'd call much. Johnny felt on the defensive. Not much fine hollowware. Plenty of buckles, spoons, and such.
How many boys?
3 of us, sir.
I'd hardly think he'd need 3. Now, if he wants to cut down, you tell him from me that I'll buy your unexpired time. I think between us we can make some fine things, you and I.
The boy flushed. To think the great Paul Revere wanted him.
Tell your master I'll pay a bit more than is usual for you. Don't let him shunt one of those other boys off on me.
He stood up. It was time for Johnny to go. I couldn't leave the Lapham, sir, he said as he thanked Mr. Revere. If it wasn't for me, nothing would ever get done. They'd just about starve.
I see. You're right, of course, but if the old gentleman dies or you ever want a new master, remember my offer.
So, and he turned to shake hands, may we meet again.
2. By Saturday afternoon, Johnny, following Mr. Revere's advice and his curve, had got the model of the handle exactly right. He could tell with his eyes closed. It felt perfect. He rapidly made a duplicate, for when the molten silver was poured in on the wax, it would melt and float away, so he made a model for each handle. Now, no matter how long it took him, and if all went well, it should not be too long, he must get his handles cast, cleaned, and soldered to the basin itself which Mr. Lapham had made. Of course, on Sunday the shop would be locked up all day, the furnace cold. Mr. Lapham would, as always, escort his household, dressed in Sunday best, to the Cockrell Church, and after that back for a cold dinner. Whether they went out again or not to afternoon meeting, the master left for each to decide. He himself always went. Madge and Dorcas usually entertained their beau. Mrs. Lapham slept. Scylla would take his Anna out along the little beach. Johnny, Dove, and Dusty were apt to steal off for a swim, although Mr. Lapham had no idea of it. He thought they sat quietly at home and that Johnny read the Bible out loud to them. So Sunday was out. But if he got up at 3 or 4 Monday morning, he would have time to clean his work before he took it over to Mr. Hancock at 7. After Saturday dinner, Mr. Lapham, as usual, prepared for a snooze, stretched out in the one armchair in the shop, with his basket over his head to keep off the flies. Perhaps Johnny's tyranny during the week had irritated the old gentleman, who never believed it made the least difference to anyone when anything was finished. "Dove! Dusty!" Johnny was yelling. "Build up the furnace. Fetch in charcoal. Hi, you lazy good-for-nothing dish mops!" Dove ran out to the coal house. There was a queer, pleased look on his face when he returned. "Charcoal all gone, Master Johnny."
"Gone?"
"Yep. I haven't said anything because you always like to take charge of things like that round here."
"Get a basket, quick. Run to Mr. Hamblem over on Long Wharf. Try Mrs. Hitchborn down on Hitchborn's Wharf. You've got to get charcoal. Hurry."
Dove did not hurry. It was getting on towards sunset when at last he came back, pushing his big basket on a wheelbarrow. It was the worst-looking charcoal Johnny had ever seen.
"This isn't what we silversmiths use. This is fourth-rate stuff. Fit for iron, maybe. You know that, Dove."
"Nah, not me. I don't know anything. See? You're always telling me."
"I want willow charcoal."
"You never said so."
"I'll go myself, but this delay means we'll be working in lamplight and up to midnight. You are the stupidest animal God ever made, if he made you, which I doubt. Why your mother didn't drown you when you were a pup, I can't imagine.
Come Lord's Day and I have a spare moment, I'm going to give you such a hiding for your infernal low-down skulking tricks you'll be—" The basket over Mr. Lapham's head moved. He laid it down.